I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Slavery and the City, a three-part series brought to you by the Open City Podcast. This series is about Britain's role in the transatlantic slave trade and its legacy embodied in the City of London.
The biggest gathering London has seen in weeks and one of the most passionate.
These are difficult histories. And indeed, particularly when power indeed and finance mix.
So you cannot separate racism from capitalism. One does not emerge without the other.
Through an in-depth examination of three key buildings in the capital, this series attempts to uncover Britain's role within the black diaspora, how it profited directly and indirectly from the trading of slaves, and questions how architecture continues to convey cultural and social power in 2021. In episode 2, we examined London's Guildhall in relation to the Zong massacre, what we mean by collective amnesia, and how the buildings and statues of our city play a role. In this episode, we're looking at how informal spaces such as pubs and coffee houses around our cities can be the site for establishing power, but also how they can become places of resistance. Through a roundtable with a member of the interdisciplinary design collective, Resolve, we question what we mean by informal spaces and the myths and the rituals that mobilise power. I'm Selassie Setifa, and this is Slavery and the City. We're going to start today's episode with a conversation about the first coffee house in London. Joining me to discuss this is Open City Podcast co-host Aman Nuri. Hey Aman.
Hello.
What is the relevance of the Jamaica Wine House, or as it was known back then, the Jamaica Coffee House?
Situated in St. Michael's Alley, Cornhill, the Jamaica Wine House is a redstone Victorian pub hidden within the narrow back streets of the City of London. It's a pub now, but this building started life back in 1652 as London's first coffee house. Coffee houses were convivial places where poets, politicians, playwrights, students and merchants discussed and debated the news, culture and current affairs of the day. Dr. Matthew Green wrote in the Telegraph that coffee houses brought people and ideas together. They inspired brilliant ideas and discoveries that would make Britain the envy of the world. The first stocks and shares were traded in Jonathan's Coffee House by the Royal Exchange. But of course, what is erased in this account is how these coffee houses came to be, what went on there, and what role they play in the systems of colonialism, empire, and the slave trade. Let's look at the product, the coffee, that was sold across roughly 3,000 coffee house establishments in London by the 18th century. Along with sugar, this is a primary commodity produced by enslaved Africans.
Besides just selling drinks, how else did establishments like the Jamaica Coffee House support the slave trade?
So the first places we see stocks and shares traded takes place here, in these casual spaces. Later on, we see the trading process formalised within the walls of the Royal Exchange and legitimised by laws and policies created in the Guildhall. Social spaces like the Jamaica Coffee House also became vital hubs of commercial activity. Unlike in the rival alehouses, the drink of choice here was vitally a stimulant. Coffee fueled conversations and social networks that entrenched the slave trade and created a global financial system of inequality still with us today.
Thanks for that explanation, Aman. Together, we sat down with Akhil Scaife-Smith.
All right. So my name is Akhil Scaife-Smith. I'm one of the co-founders and 1/4 of Resolve Collective, which is an interdisciplinary design collective that looks at art, architecture, engineering and technology to address social issues.
First off, we began by asking Akhil how informal spaces like the coffee house came to play such an important role in the slave trade.
Well, I think there are a number of ways in which a space might do that, and you know, to take a typical space or the idea of space, and I think some of them are in conflict and some of them I think work in tandem. One is this idea of the space as a repository, right? So a space as a repository for social function, and in that respect you might see something like the Jamaica Coffee House or Jamaica Wine House as being the obvious place in which larger systems might accrete, and you have these places by which like the power is consolidated in informal spaces, in spaces for informality, in spaces for public relationships. And when we see space as a repository for these kind of social functions and social systems, I think it's almost like an obvious point of focus. When alternatively, I think there's probably the case to be made for spaces, and particularly spaces like this, informal ones, to actually play a more central role, a less passive one in formalizing, or sorry, in accounting for power dynamics. And if we look at, you know, across the board, how social spaces have often consecrated social inequality, I think it's by no surprise that in somewhere like the Jamaica Coffee House, in somewhere that kind of predicated on informality, is where actually we find power being consolidated. So I think there are two ways to look at it, and I don't think either or are necessarily, you know, right and wrong. But that's a kind of broad overview, I'd say, of a kind of sociology of space, and potentially as to why we might find that. In this case of the slave trade, in the case of something such an insidious system, at the heart of it, we have something so informal and so loose, like a little place to get together.
Absolutely, because it is that, you know, it's that idea of spaces outside the office, whether it's like the modern day pub or like the golf course, obviously being like the epitome of kind of like the informal space where relationships and networks are developed. It's that kind of idea, right?
For sure. I mean, I think it's an interesting one because, again, looking at it through two ways, like there's in one hand there's this idea that the liquor, the excess in any form, like whether it might be like shisha bars in the Ottoman Empire, whether it's I'm sure they weren't called shisha bars then, but like, you know what I mean, like where or coffee houses here, gin palaces, whatever, but the pub, is that excess something that catalyzes business relationships? Is it an addition to business relationships? And that suits this idea of space as a repository for social functions. Or is it the crux, right? Is it like this kind of sovereign paradox that outside of power is what that outside of the law is what rules? That outside of the rules is what rules. Like, is it actually the foundation of power? And I, you know, sometimes when I'm feeling provocative, and I'm sure everyone kind of leans this way sometimes, I feel like that is. I feel like it's not necessarily an add-on. It's not necessarily an annex. It's not necessarily where, where kind of a previously dynamic power formation sedents and stops becoming productive and therefore starts, you know, revealing its true colours. I think it is the colour. You know what I mean? Like, it's a really interesting space in that respect. As are all pubs in even a kind of in this contemporary context around, you know, unlocking post-COVID and these kind of things. There's a lot to be said.
It's akin to how we kind of, I think, as a society, I guess, position members clubs today, right? So you have these like members clubs often in quite plush parts of town, which are exclusive and which pride themselves on being exclusive and which absolutely encourage the kind of activities and conversations which are so fundamental to preserving and developing power. So it's, I don't know, you know, at the time Jamaica Coffee House wasn't a members club. It isn't a members club, but it's that idea of these kind of exclusive spaces which cater to a group of people, and by that exclusivity, that exclusivity allowing them to have a safe space, right? Have a kind of one contained space where they can get up to all their ills and wrongdoings.
The comparison with the members club is probably an interesting revelation into what kind of space we feel like it is, in being central or not to how, you know, how the slave trade was conducted and how these systems of power are consolidated. I think, you know, that it's not a members club makes it in some ways more pernicious, and but also reveals it to me, it's like pushes me towards this idea of this space or a space as being instead like this kind of central to it, these informal spaces, you know, what acts as the members club, what acts as the kind of the exclusivity, the shibboleth, is ritual. And in that respect, it's very similar to like a lot of pubs, a lot of local pubs that you might see in your local area. You know, the type of rituals that are expected of you there. You know what it feels like to walk into a pub where you're not necessary, where you're not, you know, not familiar with, and people aren't familiar with you. You know, where there might be racial dynamics, there might be gender dynamics, there might be all sorts of things going at play. None of that is written in some statutory paper. None of that is consecrated by law. All of that is ritual. And that leads, and ritual is inherent, you know, let's call ritual something that's beyond text. And in that way, being informal, I think that's where we start to draw these parallels, right? If that an informal space like this is exactly where rituals of power are consolidated, because the space is highly ritualistic. It's not the kind of thing where people are writing things. It's not the kind of things where text is how we disseminate or how we consolidate power. It's a thing. It's a place of handshakes. It's a place of rituals. It's a place of eye contact. It's a place of things that aren't said. And even that makes it seem too haughty, right? Even that makes it seem too haughty. The informality is rife in these spots. That's why they can be fun at the best of times. And that's probably why they can be these apexes of kind of colonial power at the worst of times.
Can I just add something on that point of what's the sort of informality and the ritual, ritualistic nature of it all, and what's said and what's unsaid? One of the things that I've come across is that most of these sort of coffee houses were places where people would put up posters for their escaped or missing slaves or whatever. So in doing that is obviously becoming some sort of unspoken rule where if you were a free slave, for example, you wouldn't be stepping foot in that type of environment because you are of the understanding that people are getting captured, or people are reporting people who need to be captured in this space. So it becomes a safe space for certain sects of people and an unsafe space for certain sects of people. And whether that's said or not said or implied, I think it's implied by that sort of action or that activity.
I mean, stick with me here, because I'm going to try and take this a little bit stratospheric. But I was listening to a really amazing lecture by Charmaine Nelson. Charmaine Nelson is an art historian, and she does a lot of work about slave accounts. Reports of missing slaves. And she's comparing the archives in Kingston, Jamaica, to the archives in Montreal. She's making these really powerful comparisons between the two slave kind of systems of slavery. And she's saying the key to really find any information about this, about any slave themselves, in her research was through these missing papers. And actually, it's when property goes missing is when you're most descriptive about it. When you're trying to sell something or someone, you know, you'll tell people what they want to hear, and you know, the less information in some ways is the better. You can be Machiavellian about it in some ways. But actually, these papers are these huge these massive communicators of really, really personal information. And I think there's definitely something there about communicating about these highly communicative, these highly literal, these highly descriptive accounts being in these places by which ritual demands a kind of a hush, a kind of, you know, don't get me wrong, these are loud places. I'm sure there was a bit of a ruckus going on in the Jamaica House in particular. But, you know, like the ritual spaces we were talking about, I'm sure it was centred on lots of things that weren't being said, a lot of agreements that weren't being made, a lot of handshakes that weren't being had, in this place of absence. And it's a place that is then left out of the story, and then a place that is then left out of the story of slavery, left out of our history of slavery, no longer in the central conversation when we think about the Wilberforce forces, when we think about, you know, the Zongs, the Jamaica Winehouse, these informal spaces aren't there, they're not within that business category. So that juxtaposition of this space of the unsaid and space that is now unspoken about with these highly communicative pieces of literature, all these, you know, these posters, these flyers, these graphic things. I don't know, there's something there, isn't there?
We can now see how spaces like the Jamaica Coffee House were just as important as more widely recognised centres of power, like the Guildhall and Royal Exchange. Through various means, all of these institutions legitimised the process in which millions of Africans were involuntarily moved across the Atlantic. This process contributes enormously to the current day African diaspora.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Taking the conversation into the present day, we asked Akhil what diasporic space looks like and means today.
So this idea of diasporic space I find quite interesting and appealing, because I'm interested not just as diasporic spaces as places by which the diaspora accumulate, not of spaces which happen to be full of people from the diaspora, but what does it mean to like be a, for the space itself to be diasporic? I think that comes when not only the space is full of those bodies, but when the program is designed by those bodies, when the scheme of the space, you know, when its DNA has been influenced in a meaningful way by the aspirations, by the wants and needs, by the behaviours of the diaspora, of a diaspora. And there we might think of a truly diasporic space. Perhaps that space doesn't have walls. Perhaps that space doesn't stay put. You know, I think that space is going to be more like playing mass than it is like building mass, and that by that I mean playing like jumping, like carnival. We open up these really new radical possibilities for what space can actually be and mean, and I find that really, really interesting. Spaces I might call diasporic spaces, I think, also need to be talked about with a kind of through a temporal lens. Like these spaces which we hold dear to us, that often aren't as, you know, that are so often in situations of really high precarity, spaces which we end up having taken from us, or spaces that are kind of allowed to degrade by design. These kind of spaces, they are diasporic spaces in a meaningful way, but also a temporal way. And that's not entirely what I mean when I think I'm considering diasporic space. So I'm thinking about a space that might not exist yet in a formative, in like a formal way, or maybe it does and we haven't appreciated it to be that, but really not like, yeah, really about not the space as full of diaspora, but the space as diasporic by the diaspora.
You kind of talked about the reappropriation of space, which perhaps isn't built by diasporic communities, and then you're talking about space which is built by those bodies, which is built by those communities, and you can see that at multiple layers of the ownership and the governance and the programming. Is there more power in either or. You know, if we're talking about the need for these communities to have more power within urban space, to have more power within society, and the kind of centrality of space to achieving those outcomes, is one approach more powerful than the other? Is one space more conducive to diaspora communities getting their bread, getting their butter in a place like the UK?
I mean, it certainly seems like it, right? It certainly seems like the kind of more formal and accredited space is the place by which power is consolidated. It certainly seems like that might be the way. And in the context of diaspora, you might suppose that is the case. At the same time, I think it might be worth thinking about the deep structures of power and actually land ownership being one of them. And by the same mechanisms by which we have security in spaces, are the same mechanisms by which we may find ourselves in positions to abuse power rather than to disrupt. So the informality of spaces of resistance that I think often offers our communities precarity shouldn't be disregarded, because it's that resistance, it's that position of resistance which offers a longer term change. And it's perhaps that shorter term, that shorter term value, that shorter term security, which is really like the Yanis face of power, inviting us in and then taking us into the heart of this kind of deep structure, and we become proponents of that. So I think it's a difficult one. And yeah, ask me when I'm in a position to be in a place that's secure, I think my answer will be relatively straightforward. I'll contradict everything I just said. But like, ask me from a conceptual standpoint, ask me from, you know, the standpoint of like my creative practice, I think that I'd stand by it.
Because there's a certain symbolism when we look at spaces like, you know, the Tate or the V&A get taken over by communities, by diasporic communities. And the one thing that immediately just comes to my mind here is when Galdem did the takeover at the V&A a few years ago. And I just found that like a very, from a symbolic perspective, really powerful, because it was this, you know, the V&A that's like probably like maybe can only be usurped by the British Museum in its kind of like institution of colonialism, right? Like, it's full of these artifacts, the plunder of the empire as they went around the world, right? And there's a certain symbolism to an organization like Galdem, which represents Black, brown communities within the UK and elsewhere, being in that space and occupying that space and saying something there. I think the kind of downfall of that argument, though, is that it's as you said yourself, there's a kind of transience about it, and perhaps they're not afforded the space or the time to actually disrupt the power structures, which, you know, we need to disrupt, right? Like, we need to be challenging these power structures, these narratives. And I think therefore the argument is perhaps that, you know, we need to be creating our own institutions, creating our own spaces and ascribing permanence in that. And that for me is, it kind of comes down to the different offerings that these sort of approaches provide, and also the realities of the city, right? Because I know you've spoken and written about this loads, about the fact that, you know, the kind of the temple, the transient condition is something that it's a product of London. Like, it's almost unrealistic to expect anything else, given the land regulations, the flows of money and property that dominate the city, that, you know, it's hard to reach for anything else.
There is a conversation, a well-developed one, and of which I'm not the expert, of these takeovers. They would tell you that it is, of course, not enough. The touch and base thing at the Tate wasn't enough. None of the things there were ever enough, will be enough. And it's always about asking for more. It's about being invited in that space, not to disrupt, but being core to that space, like being irreplaceable in that space, not a kind of novelty, not just disrupting novelty. There was also a kind of sadomasochism to the art world, right? To some extent, in the kind of reintroduction of decolonialism, of decolonizing the museum, and etc. etc. You know, there's a sadomasochism to it. It's all these museums are like, yeah, like, you know, tell me how bad I am. The British Library are like, yeah, tell me all the dirt I've done. Of course they are. They love it. They do.
I love that.
And when you're in that position, when you're in that position being invited in there, you understand that too. That's part of your discomfort, 100%. So I think that there is a, you know, so I think that there's something like, that line of argument is not to be transient in that space, not to be the person who is invited in that space, but to be that person who is demanded in that space, who needs to be in that space, who's given formal roles in these spaces. I there's another argument though, that as always, there's more things to more ways to skin this cat. And it's also about being in that space at all, right? It's also about being in that space at all. And I think some of the conversations that are going right now about how these cultural institutions can become social infrastructure are starting to do away, and how these can become redistributive. They become dissipative. They can start to support things that are already going on in local areas. They can start to support these initiatives without reconsolidating or continually, perpetually consolidating themselves as centers of power, but rather as, you know, the dissipated of them, as a system by which power might be distributed, an infrastructure. The question of being there or not being there, you know, becomes kind of falls out of vogue. Who cares if I'm invited there for a takeover or not? Like, who cares if I'm doing this or not? The key question really is, how can we repurpose this? How can we reappropriate institutional space to make it infrastructural? How can we use the power to deliver social benefit to places outside, well outside of the museum, and with new rhetorics that are being kind of indulged in around the movement of museums, the V&A East is a good one that we're involved in at the moment, but like lots of other situations, the Tate have a huge focus at the moment on Croydon, Lewisham, a number of other boroughs as well. They're looking outside of these places. That's an opportunity for practitioners, cultural practitioners like Galden, spatial practitioners like us, curatorial and writers like Skin Deep, like whoever, to start really grabbing that and to start thinking about how we can change the nature of this space. How can we change the topological nature of this space, not just the look? Let's not just get lots of black bodies into the Tate. Let's make the Tate something that supports black bodies where they are already.
It is about reappropriation, right? It's about reinstituting. You know, it's not just the bricks and the facades of these institutions which are the problem, right? It's the practices which shape them, and it's the practices they perpetuate. So if you go in and take a different approach, whether it is about the ownership, whether it is about the governance, whether it's about the hiring practices, whether it's about, you know, geographically how they're distributed across a city, these are all things which can be changed, right? So when we talk about decolonizing these institutions, that is a very feasible scenario to be navigating, right? Because it's not like we're coming here saying these things need to be dismantled, we need to take the bricks down and just like plot them and put them in Lewisham, right? We're just saying that there needs to be like a different set of processes and practices which you develop and perpetuate, and and what are the implications of that for empowerment, for racial equality? These are the things that we need to be striving towards.
Listening to what you're both saying, what I'm hearing is that we need to move beyond sort of the disruptive event and move towards a sort of more embedded system and process that's continually striving towards sort of more addressing inequalities and addressing and confronting histories, but doing that in a continuous, progressive way and not just looking to one sort of disruptor event taking place as this takeover And then you move on, but you're still back to existing and practicing in the same ways that you always have done. And you haven't really, have you really contributed anything to the culture or to those organizations that have come and taken over and disrupted your space for that one sort of event that is kind of held in place as something that people remember as a great event and a great disruptor, but it doesn't make any real lasting change on your established systems and ways of being and existing as an institution.
I think they have a place, those events, but it's not the be all end all, right? Like, I think they do have a place. I think there is power in the actual act of gathering, like bringing all your crew, all your friends, people you're just going to meet, and the opportunities that arise from those conversations. It's that has to go alongside an analysis of hiring practices, or like, literally, if you've got this one institution here, what else are you doing around the rest of the city? Like, how you're dispersed, how you're hiring, your collections, it's the whole concoction of what makes an institution has to be analysed.
It's like that one event should really be a catalyst. It shouldn't be a stagnant thing that just happens one time and then that's, you know, one, you know, you're done. It should always end up being a catalyst. And I fear that oftentimes, because I'm kind of thinking, okay, so what if we got into the conversation of what could the Jamaica Wine House be going forward? What is it about plugging in programs that is more inviting to these diasporic communities, and plugging into things that are happening in more contemporary spaces? But then I feel like, okay, that might be a solution, but is that going to be a sort of a one-time event, or is it really going to be a sort of catalytic thing that spurs us onto a new, you know, a new way of being and existing and repurposing these spaces and reappropriating these spaces and really confronting that history whilst we do that, not forgetting it, addressing it, but really creating spaces that push us into a future that is dealing with the past whilst also supporting these contemporary organizations and institutions and what Black bodies need in sort of contemporary society.
In episode 1, we broke down the definitions of empire and imperialism through the lens of the Royal Exchange. In episode 2, we re-examined the abolitionist movement in relation to the horrific Zong massacre and the Guildhall. This final episode was a lot more about the relevance of the spaces buildings synonymous with the slave trade provide, and in particular, questioning if buildings like the Jamaica Wine House have ever or could ever provide spaces that serve London's present-day Black communities. I'm Selassie Setifa, and you're listening to Slavery and the City.
This episode has been produced in partnership with the City of London Corporation as part of its drive to tackle racism in all its forms. Its Tackling Racism Task Force is leading this work, assessing what further action the City Corporation can take to promote economic, educational and social inclusion, and considering how to respond to the historical issues such as statues and monuments. You can find out more at ourcitytogether.london. If you'd like to hear the full interview with Akhil Scaife-Smith, sign up to become an Open City friend and you will be able to access the full interviews with Selassie and all the amazing contributors for this series. For $1.25 a week, you can support the hosting costs of the Open City podcast, helping to keep conversations about the city open, honest and accessible. Alongside the Open City podcast, we have The Lundown, our weekly roundup of the week's top London architecture news. Tune in every Thursday morning with Merlin Fulcher and a roster of special guests.